Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
I think a sense of teamwork and a sense of work ethic and a sense of taking care of yourself is, has been important for me.
My guest today is Shoshana Stewart, chief executive of Turquoise Mountain. Turquoise Mountain is a non-governmental organization founded by His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales and the President of Afghanistan to revive the Afghan craft industry and regenerate the center of the old city of Kabul. Now the organization's central aim is to preserve and regenerate historic areas and communities with a rich cultural heritage and to revive traditional crafts in order to create jobs, skills, and a renewed sense of pride. Shoshana joined Turquoise Mountain in 2006 before becoming CEO in 2009. Prior to Turquoise Mountain, she worked as a teacher and administrator in low-income urban communities with Teach for America and Uncommon Schools in New York City, Boston, and Honduras. While at university, she was a four-time All-American Oarswoman and a three-time NCAA champion and has since completed the London and Philadelphia marathons. Shoshana Stewart, welcome to Conduit Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about your upbringing and your childhood. What influenced you to pursue a life so clearly committed to social justice?
Well, I was born in New York, not the city, upstate New York. And I suppose that my parents always worked in things that they, I suppose, to describe their jobs, they worked in the government. My dad ran a lot of nonprofits, ran Outward Bound and hole-in-the-wall gang camps, which was for kids with terminal conditions. They just always talked about their job in terms of what it did. I mean, that was the sort of conversation around the house. So it wasn't a particular choice. I just always thought you did something that you liked the outcome of.
And was there sort of a tacit expectation in your family that you would be working in sort of stuff that led to positive social change? When did you know that you were likely to do that? Was there a moment, or just did you just sort of kind of default into it?
No expectation at all. My parents really said we could do whatever we wanted, which really came back to bite them when I moved to Kabul about 12 years ago. And, you know, the tears were flowing and they were like, did you really, really have to take us up on that? No, I think I'm a real unbeliever in life planning. So I don't know, you know, I started teaching after college because I liked kids and I thought it seemed like a good idea. And then went to Afghanistan, was tagging along with somebody and sort of fell into this job. So I think that I've done what I liked and what I enjoyed, and that's where I am.
As an unbeliever in life planning, I read that you studied astrophysics in university.
Yeah, that's a great example of that.
Why astrophysics, and how does that connect to Afghanistan?
So, yes, it connects in an incredible number of ways. Astrophysics because I like science. I like science and math. And I went to a liberal arts school, which is quite an American thing, a sort of traditional American college thing, where you study a lot of different things. You pick a major, but you only do, you know, a quarter of your classes in that. So I loved science. I loved Star Trek. So I did astrophysics. But I sort of majored in rowing. that was a lot of my time. But actually, the way that a liberal arts education works is you are meant to get a sort of rounded education, and you can do lots of things with that. Trying to make sure that you can write well and that you can do math, so I was a science teacher after that. But I do think that the connection to Afghanistan feels like, I suppose, a sense of numbers is probably the thing that I use the most, building budgets and things like that, which is quite a boring connection. But
we're going to return to Afghanistan. I have two related questions. One is your life as an athlete. A surprising number of people who go on to excel and build and create things have also had lives as athletes. So is there some connection between your life as a rather exceptional athlete and what you're currently doing? Have there been skills or experiences that in some way connected?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I wasn't that much of an athlete for a long time. We always skied when I was younger, so I always was a little bit athletic, but I watched a lot of TV till I was like 12 or 13. And my parents very, very sweetly just let me do that. And then I decided to just try the rowing team one year. And it did change me. I mean, I think that just working hard and having to work hard and work hard with a lot of other people around you is an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing for young women, definitely. I think team endurance sports in particular, because it's really about effort. It isn't about, this is unfair to say about more coordinated sports, I mean, football and tennis and things, which are, I suppose, more skill-based, but you can come to rowing fresh and just work really hard and take care of your body, which is a great thing, and get good at it and excel at it very quickly. So, I think a sense of teamwork and a sense of work ethic and a sense of taking care of yourself has been important for me.
If there's ever a cause of optimism, is you can come at something with no skill, work hard, and excel at it. I'm sure there's a life lesson there.
Yes, exactly. Also, showing up in Afghanistan, knowing absolutely nothing about Afghanistan, and then deciding I was going to stay there, I suppose. It's a little bit like me starting my rowing career.
I think we're finding silver threads in your life. So let's talk about your work at Teach for America. And I'm sure there are stepping stones between that and Turquoise Mountain. But what drew you to be a science teacher in low-income communities? And tell me about that experience.
Yeah, I think there are there's one particular parallel that I think is important. So I love kids. I was a summer camp counselor for many years, and teenagers in particular. For some reason, I like the sort of 13-year-old age. I always thought that teaching and working with kids would be interesting, and Teach for America was really on the rise in recruiting, and I thought, God, that's an amazing idea. The idea that every kid, regardless of where they come from, deserves a great education. So I interviewed, got a job, did it in Harlem. So I worked at the Harlem Renaissance Military and Leadership Academy, which was a New York City, government school in its third phase of warning. It was in a pretty tough state. But I got a class of kids the first year it was an inclusion class, which means that it was mixed special education, regular education. So it was kids who were on education plans for a variety of quite mild learning disabilities through to behavioral plans, which just meant that they were behaving badly and they were put on plans for it. And then kids who didn't have any plans. And what I got was very interesting, which is a group of kids who'd been put together for 3 years in one classroom. They didn't start to move classrooms like other kids do at 11 and 12 years old. And they were kind of forgotten about. And they lived in a place with a lot of crime. They themselves were not hardened in any way. They just hadn't been taught anything in a long time. So I had the most wonderful, there's one particular girl I'm thinking of who did her homework every single night, came to school every single day, behaved beautifully, and she could barely read. And that's what happens when you basically are in an atmosphere where everybody is at a much lower level of education. Teachers have a hard time teaching because they're dealing with behavior problems, and that's how it goes. And I guess I saw something there, which is what it looks like to not have all the benefits of what a country like America can provide, and what families were struggling with in terms of accessing healthcare and nutrition and lots of different things. So the complexities and realities of growing up in a difficult area of New York City is what, I think a young teacher in Teach for America learns a lot more probably than he or she is able to teach in the beginning, and that was certainly true for me. I then went on to teach at a charter school in Boston called Roxbury Prep, which was an incredible, incredible place. And this is where I think, this is the thing that I took from them is what I took from Afghanistan, which is simply that you just have high expectations all the time. So Roxbury Prep, we would take kids who were typically 2 to 3 levels behind, grade levels behind in sixth grade, so when they were 11, keep them for 3 years, and basically they would be at or above grade level according to state averages when they left. So we would do 5 or 6 years of school in 3. And they stayed at school for 8-9 hours a day, and they had 2 hours of homework every night. And they were just held to impeccable educational and behavioral standards. And we told them that they were going to run the world. We told them they could be president. And it was very, you know, it was very meaningful when Barack Obama was running for president and when was elected, because it was a predominantly African-American and Hispanic group of kids. And it meant a heck of a lot to see him to see him do that. But at any rate, the idea that people who are not expected to excel, you just say, no, you are going to. You have what it takes to offer the world, you know, absolutely limitless things, and you're going to do it. And I think that's the way that I suppose we've sort of approached craft in Afghanistan, for example, and trying to rebuild the old cities. It's not, I think it's important that it's not, you know, Afghanistan, you're a bit of a basket case, you are uneducated, you don't really treat women right, you're not healthy, we're going to come and help you, but rather, gosh, your buildings are incredible. And you have these amazing traditions and ceramics and carpets and jewelry, and we can sell them in New York and in London and Dubai and in Afghanistan, and you're going to, you know, compete in the sort of luxury market, is all from that idea of high expectations, I suppose.
So take us on the journey from Boston and from schools to Kabul. What took you there? And then we'll talk in much greater detail about Turquoise Mountain.
Total serendipity. This is what makes me the unbeliever in life planning. I was tagging along with somebody who was doing research in Afghanistan, and I always said I would go along. So I took a year off of school and off of teaching and moved there. And, you know, I thought I was going to be just kind of living in a village in Afghanistan, and I was just going to experience a different place and go on an adventure. Found this job volunteering and just got sucked in immediately, just started running around doing things. It was in the first year of the project, so there was a lot of things to do. And I just stayed. I have found that I love being in other people's countries. I just love different languages, different food, trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, conservative older Afghan men and trying to navigate even different languages within Afghanistan and government officials and different ethnicities. And it's just fascinating. I love it. I loved living in Kabul. I spent 5 years there, and it was one of the most fun things that I probably will ever do.
So tell us a story about what Turquoise Mountain does with craft, with local communities.
So thank you for asking. So if you can picture Afghanistan, so I will try to help people picture Afghanistan. 2006, so this is 4 years after the fall of the Taliban and the sort of international presence in Afghanistan. There were no streetlights at night, so the place looked like a semi-war zone. A lot of buildings had collapsed. That's partially because of frontline fighting, but it's also just because of neglect. I mean, when you don't have a functioning government for decades, you don't have any services. People don't clean stuff up. And it was so long ago that they never really had services. They didn't really have much central water supply, sanitation, electricity. So that stuff was never built in the first place. So, but the old city of Kabul, these incredible courtyard buildings, so a blank mud wall, and you walk into the center through this little doorway, and you get these carved wooden colonnades. But that bit of the old city was 6 feet under garbage because all of these, they're mud buildings, had collapsed. So you have house-sized piles of dirt. So the old city was a mess, and the artisans weren't really producing anymore. I mean, all of the older generation, these very, very famous woodworkers and ceramicists had, you know, many of them had left their villages, had been in Pakistan and had come back, or maybe they'd stayed, or maybe they'd moved to Kabul. But they hadn't passed it down. So that's how it started. And we just began by cleaning out the garbage. So we had just employed like hundreds of guys to clear garbage out of the old city. Then started to repair the building. So we were employing people and training people on restoration, how basic carpentry, but also conservation techniques and electrics and plumbing and all the rest. And at the same time, we just got a ton of students and put them under these old masters and started initially just making things. and then eventually a more formalized curriculum and a 3-year vocational training course with accreditation. But in the beginning, we were just getting calligraphers and woodworkers just working. And so fast forward, the old city over the course of the last 10 years has transformed back to its sort of former glory, which is that it was sort of, for many years, walking over piles of garbage and raw sewage because there was no, you know, no sanitation. But we put in all that, put in water supply, sanitation, electricity, rebuilt 150 of these historic buildings, and put our Institute for Traditional Craft in the middle of it. So if you walk around there today, and actually we did both a Google Arts and Culture site, which is like a virtual tour of Mord Honey. We Google Street Viewed the old city. So you can walk around and see what it looks like, but also on our website, just launched yesterday, actually. It's called Explore Mord Honey, and it is, again, a sort of virtual experience of the old city, because I want to bring people there. Because what it looks like today is stone paving, these beautiful mud walls, and this incredibly decorative, fancy carved woodwork, and gardens everywhere, and roses, and then all these artisan businesses set up. So we've set up about 30 businesses, little woodworking and jewelry businesses that export. So it is, feels like an old city that you'd find in any great capital city, where you have beautiful buildings, places to drink tea, people making things, you can buy things, you can buy fresh bread. You hear the clank of the blacksmiths. It's, you know, the old city of Kabul is a really miraculous place.
So what suffuses that story is just this great sense of optimism, this great sense of humanity, this great sense of people being creative entities. So tell us the hard things that you have to do in order to achieve that unbelievably beautiful and inspiring vision, because there's no question that this doesn't happen easily or automatically.
Yeah, no, it's pretty messy. I mean, I suppose one thing is government is hard. So when we started, this part of the old city, this neighborhood, was scheduled for demolition because it was still zoned under the old Soviet master plan for destruction and block apartments to be built up. It's smack in the middle of the city. It's prime real estate. But they just never gotten around to knocking it down. So it was still zoned for that. And the municipality said, knock it down. This place, I mean, it was a slum. This is a place where people came as they returned to Afghanistan. Every ethnic group is represented there. Only about 20% of the people there are landowners. It was a really transient place. And so trying to get that zone so that it was protected was a big deal. So I spent a lot of time because in a place where the government is fighting with itself and has a debatable level of control over things, has control over some things and not other things, right? You can just build up a cement building in the middle of the old city. The department for preserving the old city is not actually going to come and stop you. So what do you do in that situation? You go and get letters from every single department of every single ministry that matters. So you get every building protected in the Ministry of Culture on their protected list. You get it rezoned under the Ministry of Urban Development Master Plan. You get the Kabul municipality to write a contract for these. I mean, everything under the sun to protect it. And still, every 3 years, I've got somebody trying to knock down a building and all these things, right? That will be constant. I mean, it's why we are not much of a policy organization. We don't run around trying to write new rules for the government. We just protect. And what's hard, but what you got to do is you just got to make people care about it enough that they're not going to knock it down. So we've had a wonderful grant from the British government through the British Council, something called the Cultural Protection Fund, to finish a number of these buildings. But one of the other things we did is just a huge visitor program where I've basically gotten every mid-level bureaucrat in every government department to come and visit Mord Honey, which is the name of this part of the old city. And at school groups all over the place so that when the piece of paper that goes across their desk says, we want to knock down these 5 buildings to build a car park, they say, no, 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 wait a minute, I've been down there. This is our culture. So there's like a kind of guerrilla effort to get people to see this. You don't actually have to convince them. As soon as they walk in, it's ultimate, immediate nostalgia and pride. And this is, oh, my grandfather used to have a house like this. This is Afghanistan. I mean, that's the wonderful thing, is all you have to do is show people. But they, you know, they don't go there and see Brigham. So I think that's one of the things that's been hard but really important. The last thing is just you're selling these things is really hard. So part of our charitable aims, as set up by the Prince of Wales, is to try to preserve the Afghan traditional craft industry, which we now do in Myanmar, we do in Saudi Arabia, and we do in Jordan, which is Jordan, Syria, and the Levant more widely. So if you're going to preserve traditions, you got to make sure people are trained. Right? You need young people doing it. But if they can't make a living doing it, they're not going to do it. So the economic backbone there is completely crucial. But that means you have to sell their things. And we've all been to places, markets in foreign countries, and you buy a thing that you think looks fun, and then you get it home, and you're sort of like, oh, that's not ever going to be worn, but is sweet, and I kind of remember, right? It can't be that. That doesn't work, particularly in Afghanistan where there's no tourism. So these had to be high-end products for international export that could be sold on their own merits. Yes, with a story, but they have to be at the right price point, the right design standard. And there are industry standards all over the place. Like you have to fireproof things and you have to get rub tests done on textiles to make sure that they will wear and tear properly. All of this stuff has to be done correctly if you're actually going to get the market drivers right for this stuff. And again, this is the hardest bit of it. I mean, to your question, and the bit that is what I think about most right now, because we're like a quarter of the way through the process probably, which is that there is a huge, huge, huge opportunity in this. And it's not just in Afghanistan. It's basically in every country, every developing country, but every country, which is that traditional skills and traditional crafts, there are millions, tens of millions of people who do these things, right? And you have a kind of $40 billion a year in growing global, ethical, sustainable goods industry, right? Every single thing that you bought in the conduit is you taking place, obviously, in that marketplace. You buy things because of their authenticity, their sustainability. It's my mom buying fair trade coffee in New York. It's buying clean makeup, right? This industry is massive and growing. It is a real market force. Those people buy these traditional crafts if they are at a certain standard. They want that uniqueness and authenticity. And they care that people are not poisoning themselves with chemical dyes and that they're not employing their children and things like that, right? So if you can connect this market force with these suppliers, you've got something real. I'm not making up a market here. You just have to do all the work to make sure that these producers are producing at the right standards and that they're taking care of themselves and that they're maintaining their uniqueness.
So there's clearly a massive opportunity here to defend and preserve culture, to generate wealth and generate dignity. And part of the complexity that I'm sure you grapple with is how much you facilitate and support that as an outsider coming in, and how much of it is domestically driven and owned and becomes sustainable in its own right. And so you're like a kickstarter to help people make that transition. How do you bridge that divide of being the outsider, the supportive outsider, but also empowering the insiders? And how do you think that through as one of the, I should imagine, core methodological goals of Turquoise Mountain?
Yeah, it's so central and so difficult. And yeah, we're a foreign organization in all these countries trying to say your culture is great. But subtlety is so important here. The devil's in the detail, right? So first of all, we just got to live in these countries that we're working in, right? So I employ about 200 people, and 10 of us, or 7 of us, are not in those countries. So the key thing is we got to live there, we got to speak the language of those countries, and we have to be embedded in the communities of artisans with whom we work. The second thing is that, and 95% more of my employees are from that country. But then you got to work really hard to enable, facilitate, support, celebrate people's ideas and artisans' ideas in particular. So I suppose the best example, and it is completely to the heart of your question, which is right, which is that we do have to think really hard about it and be serious about it, is something we call the design center in Kabul, which is that we realize that, so one of the best ways to sell these things is through people who have a route to market. In other words, you got a designer in London. So for example, Pippa Small, who's been working with us for 10 years, is very wonderful. And she comes to Afghanistan and Myanmar and Jordan 4 times a year each and designs collections. She knows her customer, she knows her price point. So she can design things with the artisans, with the motifs of that country, with the materials and skills of that country that she knows that her customers will buy, and then she buys. That is a great market driver. It is not everything, because that means that those are Pippa's designs. They are with those artisans, and those artisans are credited, and she works with them, and she helps them to learn to design their own pieces. But we realize we gotta find a way to get young Afghan designers really designing, because designing is a serious thing. You spend years, you spend a decade, you know, learning to do this, and people go to school for it, but they also get mentored and they have to explore it. So we realized we needed to help train. I mean, we needed to train a generation of Afghan designers. So the Design Center is a place, I mean, it's just within our institute, where we essentially have created a design major, where we help, we bring young Afghan men and women on that design journey. I mean, I'm using the pompous word of journey because it really isn't just like a course. It is, they got to leave Afghanistan and they need to, and I hope they will come back, and they need to find mentors, and they need to experience design trends in other places. And they also need to be rooted in making. So they begin with a year of practical work in one of our schools in calligraphy or ceramics or wood or jewelry. So I think that it's incredibly important that it is young Afghans who are deciding what Afghan design looks like. Because it's always an innovation. It is at any moment in history. It's not as though it was, you know, there is a traditional style, of course, that was different at every moment. So finding a way for them to own it is the goal.
I want to ask you a question about this very complex and contested word, culture. So you said one of the things we try and do is come in and say your culture is great and it's beautiful and it has value and it needs to be preserved. But on the other hand, not everything about every culture in the US, the UK, Germany, and Afghanistan is great, beautiful, and you want to preserve. Yeah. And here you are as a 28-year-old woman who comes from the outside into a country where gender is, as a cultural matter, incredibly contested. There are parts of great gender traditions in Afghanistan which one wants to preserve, and there's some which one pretty sure one doesn't want to preserve. So how do you wrestle with both valuing and preserving culture, but also seeking to enable people in these countries to contest culture, as culture always is everywhere in a constant act of contestation? It seems to me you live in a world of contestation and preservation at the same time, which is a hard thing.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So I think that one thing that's important is that we don't take a line on any of this. And what I mean by that is that it has been tempting at various points to say, for example, we only support female artisans. It's never felt right to me to do that for whatever reason. First of all, it ignores the fact that, for example, most woodworkers have been men historically. We have some female woodworkers, but I also really care that woodworking traditions are preserved. And that people are doing jobs that make sense for them and that they feel good about, while pushing the boundaries of those. But it's not my, this shouldn't be my decision which boundaries are pushed on. So part of it is that we stick to, I suppose, the culture in those things that are about tangible culture, like buildings, and intangible, like craft, music, gender norms, for example, not part of what we are preserving, or talk about, but we deal with every single day. And so, to that point specifically, We've trained about 1,000 Afghan artisans, and a lot of those are women. And we've set up these 30 businesses, and a lot of those businesses are run by women. And we provide a ton of support to make sure that they can. Because to be, so if you take the case of Saida. Saida is a woman, when we met her in her sort of early 20s, now later, who runs a business and travels internationally. And when we first met her, it was incredibly important that in interviewing for her for the Institute that we talk to her and to her family and say, do you really want to do this? Do you really want to come to an Institute where there are going to be men? You're not going to sit on the same bench as them, but you're going to be in the same classroom as them. And then are you all, you, Saida, your family, all really happy with the idea that you might set up a business or you might work in a business? You're going to have a salaried job probably, and you'll probably be away from home during the day. And if you choose to get married, you know, are you going to be okay with that? Is your husband's family going to be okay with that? I mean, just are you really committed to this? Because so we try to talk to people about that from the beginning. And we're not preaching that they should or shouldn't, because that's, I mean, that's just inappropriate for an organization to deal with. And we'd probably get in trouble very quickly. I mean, that's the practicalities of it. But yeah, we enable a lot of young women to take really serious positions of leadership. And so I think that through the practicalities of rebuilding stuff and setting up craft businesses, a lot of those, our young Afghans are finding their way toward the version of that that they want. We're not setting a quota on how many women we take. We encourage a lot of women to apply and try to help them through it. But I suppose that's, I mean, that's a messy answer to a messy question. And it's just the, it's what it looks like.
So we, in these conversations, try to give listeners a sense of visionary people who have built things. You're clearly that. And I'm interested in how you took something from a small idea or a small incarnation of a big idea to multiple countries, 200 employees, and how you grew that and scaled that. If somebody is trying to sort of, you know, view these conversations as a how-to, give us some of your insights of how you take a good idea and scale it in the way that you have.
Gosh, so I think there are sort of two parts. There's the beginning part and the make bigger part. Yeah. The beginning part, this was not my idea, and I could not have come up with it. Yeah. It was my now husband, but we met there, Rory Stewart, who founded it, and the Prince of Wales. And they thought that this slum in the middle of the old city of Kabul was going to be an incredible, beautiful destination. I honestly, they were crazy because it was a weird idea. And I just took it as read that we're going to do it and just started pumping through it. So I suppose the first part of that is certainly to give credit to them, but secondly to say intense practicality is the first deal. I was listening to a podcast by Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, who was interviewing, I think it was the Airbnb guys, and talking about how you can never be too big to do X, Y, and Z task. You have to, it's not only that as a sense of how much you are committed to something, but also just because you got to know what you're doing. You have to walk through and do everything yourself and build the budgets yourself. And, you know, that's an incredibly inefficient way to do things, but it totally works. You have to know every single one of your employees' names. You have to talk to them. You have to, you know, do the stock. It was a lot of stock checking in my first few years. Just like going to the back room and finding out, you know, were we coding the jewelry correctly, and all of these really boring things, and going occasionally with Habib to go buy, I can't remember, we were buying sewage pipes and really checking that they were the right spec. You got to do everything practically. Nothing is too big for people to do. So I suppose that's the first part, and that was what Reid was talking about, is that you have to be willing to be in the detail. You can't ever be too big for the detail. Then the scaling bit of it, so that is really difficult because it was a huge decision to go to Myanmar because I'm pretty anti-model because I think that the only reason anything works for us in Afghanistan, and lots of things don't work, obviously, when they don't work, you got to fix them. Right? So the only reason that those things work is because most of my employees are Afghan. We all live there. We all learn Dari. We know every minister and their kids and who's moving where. It's crucial to know those things. So how the heck am I going to do that in a country that I don't know? Right? So there had to be a compelling enough reason and request for us to do that. So then it was just about making sure that I had devoted people who were going to go and move there and live there and then employ people from Myanmar and really make it Myanmar. And that is, and it's a very different project. But I think that we have been asked to and offered funding to many times, let's roll this out, do it in 10 countries. And I just cannot do it because you can't scale that kind of thing in the way that you can, the way that Uber would do that. Right? It's not like that. These things that take intense human interaction and detail and context, scale isn't like that. So I suppose there is a real hurdle to how you get bigger and scale things when it requires that. And the answer for me has been that my country directors, first of all, it's not expanding too fast, but my country directors are all people who started in Kabul and I've known for a very long time and get the sort of Turquoise Mountain way of doing things, of generally controlled chaos.
So you've given us a sort of how to. Give us a few, boy, I wish I hadn't done that, or when you're doing this, I would strongly urge you never to do this. Because again, you know, the greatest and most inspirational leaders learn by mistake and failure and pivoting. What we try and do in this conversation is encourage people to sort of give those stories as well, because too often we sort of dwell on our successes, but not on the things that we find hard or challenging or daunting or which we wish we had done differently.
So one of the things that I wish I hadn't done and will never do again, outsourcing of any kind. Like a lot of people say they do things, but what they actually do is they take the money to do things and then they pay somebody else to do them. Everything from an entire project to the electrics in a building, right? And we do have to outsource some things. But basically I don't want to. I tried it actually with one particular element of our project in Kabul to do with healthcare. We have a clinic and we outsourced one part of that because we thought, okay, we're not medical professionals. We got to get somebody in who is a medical professional. And that is still true. We still have to have a medical professional who is governing and watching that part of the thing. But they were also controlling the operations and it didn't work. I basically don't trust anybody but myself to, you know, which is a horrible structural answer because you can't make things bigger that way. But essentially control to me is deeply, deeply important. And the further that one gets away from one's own norm. So if you're working in a country that you didn't grow up in, you don't speak the language of natively, you need more control, not less. It's not okay that, oh, I hired someone to go check on the project. I mean, that is nonsense. It's just nonsense. So it's always telling me to do that because there are experts who might be able to do something better. And it just, you know, so we are thinking, for example, thinking of how we interact with Syria, because we work Syrian artisans in Jordan and are committed to trying to preserve traditions from that region for the next generation as so much conflict is going on. You know, you can do things in Syria now if you work through a local partner. But what does that mean? It means you just send money to somebody who you can't really visit and do things with. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. So I think I have done that. I've made that mistake 3 times and I won't do it again. Another one is, there's a story my husband Rory, who our founder, tells, which is just true. It's just a good one, which is that, we had a primary school because none of the kids were going to school. So we just started a primary school of our own. And, then we thought they'd probably like a playground. It'd be nice to have a playground. So we made a little playground and they played in it for a year and it was terrific. And, one time Rory came back from a sort of fundraising trip and went in and the door was locked to the playground area. He's like, okay, where's the key? Got the key, a lot of running around, a lot of embarrassed running around. They opened it. There was like a bunch of goats asleep on the slide and it was just derelict. Like, what happened here? And the reality is they'd stopped using it for whatever reason. They felt like it was not fun, not safe, whatever. We never got to the bottom of it, really, because actually they've since asked for a playground, which we built in another place. But you try things, and sometimes they don't work, and sometimes you don't know why they don't work, because in that case, I mean, this is not our culture. So I think you've got to accept it and then move on and try again and ask them why it didn't work and then fix it. But, you know, sometimes there's not a structural reason that things don't work. You just have to try things. You don't know how people are going to react. I mean, that's the thing. It's not everything in the world can be planned, actually.
So you are 10 years in as CEO?
Yeah.
Give us your, if you had all the power in the world, if you were some omnipotent being, and in 5 years' time, you sketched out what Turquoise Mountain looked like, and you were to say, that's what, and then my wildest fantasies about what it could be have now been realized. What is that?
Yes, that's fun. So I think there are two parts to the answer. One is about the countries in which we work, and the other is about a commercial success with craft. So Mordhoney is my dream, this area of the old city. It's so beautiful, and I want to bring everybody there. So obviously I would love that tourists are able to visit there, but that is not necessarily possible. And we will bring as many Afghan tourists as we possibly can there. But that sense of everything happening in one area, which is what happens in Mordhoney, you've got traditional buildings restored, you've got an institute, you've got thriving businesses, you've got everything, healthcare, education, all happening in one place, is how I want it to be in all the countries. And that's really getting going in Myanmar. We're going to open a huge building that we've restored in the downtown of Yangon this July. But really getting a hub, a place where people from that country and visitors can go, and you don't have to be explained what the deal is. The deal is you walk in and you just see beauty and excitement and young people and thriving businesses and a complex vision of culture. Buildings, stories of where they were created, who made them. And in the case of Myanmar, for example, those are colonial buildings, the ones in Yangon that we're restoring. So that's a complicated history of who built those buildings and colonial leadership there and everything else, right? So, but just creating a hub that is benefiting that community of people and its history is told. So I want that in Myanmar. I want that in Jordan. We're looking at a restoration site now. I want that in Saudi. And the other side of that then is the commercial side, which is that we basically need to build a sort of $5 to $10 million a year turnover global craft business, which is probably focused on interiors. We're at the beginning of that. I mean, we turn over about $1 million a year through our business, which is owned by the charity of sales, and we will ramp that up pretty quickly, I think. But in order to support what will probably be 5,000-6,000 artisans a year by that point, we need a business that large. So I need to succeed at running a big, essentially manufacturing and distribution business in high-end craft.
So that strikes me as an incredibly inspirational note on which to end. Because you've sketched out what you said was a crazy vision, and a vision that you brought to life, that you've built, that you've grown, and that you are on the first steps of a much more ambitious, larger, multi-country view of pursuing. We're incredibly privileged to have you as a member of the Conduit, and an incredibly privileged to hear your story, and I'm certain will be a great source of inspiration to many. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, and you're all invited to Kabul and to all the other places.
Pack your luggage.
Pack your luggage.
Buy a ticket.
Paul's bringing you.
Shoshana Stewart, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.